This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, powered by BetterHelp.
Looking to buy your dream home or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to Stars of the Golden Age, a show that highlights the lives of legends from film, music, and the birth of television during Hollywood's Golden Age and the few years surrounding it. I am your host, Erin Carlson. Today, we will be talking about silent film and Golden Age actress Mary Astor and her infamous Purple Diaries, and the salacious scandal that she was at the center of that shocked and enticed a nation. I didn't plan for it to be, but this will actually be a two-part story. I had planned to cover the story of Eva Marie Saint next week because she turns 101 years old on July 4th, so I wanted to honor her. But this story just had so much information and I didn't want to leave anything out. So you can expect the conclusion of Mary Astor next week, and then I'll tell you all about the life of Eva Marie Saint just after her 101st birthday. Before I dive in, I would like to welcome a brand new Patreon member. A huge thank you to Nancy H. Thank you so much for supporting the show on Patreon, Nancy. So, you guys, Nancy now has access to our new fun cocktail party segment, plus a bunch of back content. Isn't she lucky? Well, you can have what Nancy has. Just visit patreon.com/starsofthegoldenagepodcast and see what it's all about. And not only do you get a ton of sweet bonus content, but you would be helping to support the hard work it takes to put out this show. I'll give you a little tease. This month's bonus episode was all about the history of movie theaters. And next month is the story behind the Ziegfeld Follies. But really, those cocktail parties are going to be a ton of fun, so it would be worth it just for that. Thank you again, Nancy. Now, on to the show. The book I read as my primary source for this story was written by one of Mary Astor's most dedicated biographers. It is really, really well written, very detailed, and very engaging. I highly recommend it if you want to dive a little deeper into the scandal that rocked Hollywood in the summer of 1936. It has every little detail about the trial that we're going to talk about today. The book is titled The Purple Diaries, Mary Astor and the Most Sensational Scandal of the 1930s by Joseph Egan. I'm going to shift my focus a little differently in this episode. Since the scandal involved in Mary Astor's story is so salacious and was such a powerful moment in Hollywood history and in Mary's life, I will be putting a lot of my focus on the scandal itself, what led up to it, and its aftermath. And that's why it has to be a two-part episode. But first, a little bit about Mary before the scandal. Mary Astor was born as Louise Vasconcelos Langhank on May 3, 1906, in Quincy, Illinois, to parents Helen and Otto. Mary's father, Otto, was a German immigrant, and her mother was an American-born woman with Portuguese roots. Little Lucille, who I will just be calling Mary throughout the story, was the only child for the couple, who were both teachers. Mary was homeschooled by her parents, mostly her mother, and her father taught her how to play the piano. Otto and Helen may sound like pretty great parents to have from the surface, but you know what they say, never trust a book by its cover. Otto was very controlling and manipulative, and the second he realized that his beautiful daughter could make his pocketbook nice and fat, he took full advantage of that, with zero concern as to how it may affect his daughter. And by doing so, he set the toxic groundwork for Mary's future relationships with men. Her father showed her that women should be controlled by men, and he eventually taught her that men cannot be trusted. Of course, these things are not true, but that is the life that Mary grew up in. Mary wasn't allowed to have any friends, and she didn't go to school, so her father had her completely blocked off from meeting anyone her own age. Her childhood was incredibly isolated, and every aspect of her life was controlled by her father. She learned very early on that to live a somewhat peaceful existence, she must follow every single order given to her by her father. In 1919, Otto sent a photograph of his 13-year-old daughter to Motion Picture Magazine, which was holding a beauty contest. Mary was a semi-finalist. Next stop, the movies. When Mary was 14 years old, her father made her become a film actress. Mary was forced to sacrifice her childhood, or what childhood she was allowed to have at least, for a life of work in an adult's world, all while her father pocketed every last cent of her earnings. And by the time she was 20 years old, those earnings totaled $4,000 per week, or $72,600 in today's money. That's a lot of money. For Otto. He took his daughter's earnings and gave himself quite the lavish lifestyle. A big, beautiful mansion, complete with a staff, of course, exquisite furnishings, a rich wardrobe, and, of course, a chauffeur-driven limousine. He picked himself up the rich guy starter pack and built on it with every luxury he could think of. I guess I'm being a little dishonest in saying that Otto took every cent of Mary's paycheck. He was kind enough to give her an allowance of $5 per week out of her eventual $4,000 per week earnings. So there is that. Even as she grew into adulthood, she was given just a small allowance of her own earnings. Mary later said of her father, quote, "I wish he had transmitted his energy and ambition to me genetically instead of using me as a channel," end quote. Mary was described as incredibly insecure and emotionally immature. She had a really difficult time in romantic relationships, yet she couldn't stay away from them. Her relationships always turned tumultuous, but when one relationship ended, she would chase new relationships anyways. More in love with being in love than actually being able to love is how it was put by biographer Joseph Egan. And, quote, "Obsessed by an uncontrollable need for over-the-top neurotically romantic as well as intensely erotic relationships," end quote. From what I gathered, Mary had a strong need to feel wanted. Can you guess where that damaged sense of love and relationship with men came from? Yep, that's right, her emotionally abusive father. He damaged his daughter so much. Mary's first famous lover was actor John Barrymore, who was 40 years old. No big deal, 40 is not old. Unless, that is, you consider the fact that Mary was only 17 years old at the start of their affair. And she had zero experience at the time with romantic relationships. John Barrymore was notorious with his sexual appetite. And with Mary Astor, he found himself a young, very naive girl to mold into his sexual puppet. And with it, He set more toxicity into that groundwork for what Mary Astor perceived as a typical loving relationship. It all began with John Barrymore manipulating a situation with Mary at the center of it, just as her father had always done. John wanted Mary for his sexual toy du jour, so he asked Father Otto if he could be her acting coach to strengthen her skill. Starstruck by the famous actor, Otto agreed. John Barrymore thought that Otto was a huge loser, but he schmoozed him and made him feel like they were peers or even friends, just to gain his trust so he would hand over some control of his daughter to him. The acting lessons began in the Langhank living room, but having Otto Langhank's watchful eye on him at all times wasn't going to gain Barrymore what he was truly after. So he convinced Otto that the lessons would be much more effective if Mary could relax away from her father's supervision. She was just too self-conscious training in front of her father, he said. Just pleased to have a big star like John Barrymore willing to help his daughter, Otto agreed to the private sessions in Barrymore's suite at the Beverly Hills Hotel. And private sessions they were, just not of the acting variety. John Barrymore groomed Mary Astor, slowly and patiently. This girl had never before been given any kind of love or affection, no verbal praise or love, and definitely no physical affection. She was never hugged by her parents or kissed goodnight. So, as a teenage girl with a man who was physically attracted to her, she was weary and afraid of physical contact. At first. But John Barrymore was a pro with the ladies, and he knew exactly what he had to do to ease her into a sexual relationship with him. He worked his magic, enticing her emotionally, intellectually, and physically. He made her want to be with him. He made himself desirable to her through careful grooming and manipulation. He had her read books on philosophy and art, but also sexually explicit material. The guy knew what he was doing with this extremely emotionally fragile and socially starved girl. Mary was fascinated and enraptured by John Barrymore, and it didn't take long for her to fall right into his trap. I don't think he was a monster. I think he did truly care about Mary, but women were somewhat disposable to him. To him, Mary was his girl of the moment. But to Mary, John was the one and only man who mattered on earth. Mary, for the first time in her life, felt love and appreciation. She felt wanted and needed. John Barrymore even asked Mary to marry him, hundreds of times it was said. And hundreds of times, she said no. She was terrified of cutting that dangerously controlling chain which she was attached to her father. He had such a manipulative control over her that she didn't have the confidence to leave him. Eventually, the affair ran its course for John Barrymore, and he moved on with another young, beautiful starlet. Mary's first heartbreak. She trusted John and thought he really, truly loved her. But she saw how easily it was for him to move on, and she witnessed him treating his new lover in the exact fashion that he had treated her. It was a hard lesson for her. Deep down, Mary knew it was the control of her father that led to the ultimate demise of her relationship with John Barrymore, on her end at least. She didn't realize right away that she was always replaceable to him. But she did see that she could still be in the bed of John Barrymore if it weren't for her father's domineering control over her. So upon seeing John with another woman, she broke. She finally stood up to her father and began confronting his behavior. For the first time in her life, she was 19 years old. It took her several months from the first time she spoke up against her father, but she finally hit the breaking point. She had to get out from under his control. So at 19 years old and a famous movie star, she packed a small bag, waited until her parents were asleep, snuck out of her second-story bedroom, attached a sash to a tree, swung to the ground like Tarzan, and ran to her freedom. At 19 years old, having been completely financially supporting her parents' lavish lifestyle for years, a 19-year-old famous film actress running away from home like a child, the home she paid for. Mary did eventually return to the mansion that she was funding, but the dynamic was different. Her departure had been a wake-up call of sorts for her father. He realized that his daughter finally somehow had a little bit of confidence and defiance, something he'd worked her whole life at preventing. And that confidence and defiance could lead to him left without her hefty paycheck. She was an adult, and she could cut him off at any moment. He had to let go a little. And with this new freedom, Mary finally began to live. She made friends, she started drinking a little, she went to parties, and she spent time with men. Lots of men. The temporary need from men gave her what she thought was love. She attached herself so tightly to men, and when the initial excitement of their romantic and sexual relationship would start to wane, she took that as a loss of love and moved on to a new man. She just needed that sense of want and need and excitement that a new relationship holds. This cycle went on for a little while until she met a man who valued her for who she was, not just what she had to offer in the bedroom. The man was 30-year-old Kenneth Hawks, a producer and director at Fox. This kind of love was different. It was authentic. And it led straight to the altar in 1928 when Mary was 22 years old. The marriage was perfect by most women's standards, but sex had taken the place of love in Mary's mind. And while there wasn't any in her marriage to Kenneth, very little at least, because of the abuse and manipulation Mary had experienced for her entire life, she thought if there was no sex, there was no love. So many men in her life had convinced her that sex was love. So Mary was stepping out on her marriage to find that form of love within the first year. But then she got pregnant, and she knew it wasn't her husband's child. Frightened by this realization and riddled with guilt, she had an abortion. This whole ordeal had been another important life lesson for her. Her husband was a really good man, and she didn't want to deceive him anymore. She would put her sexual needs aside and devote herself to her otherwise dream of a husband. Life was going to be good. Not even 2 years into their marriage, though, everything would drastically change. In January of 1930, Kenneth was personally doing a stunt in a film that he was directing, a parachute jump. The airplane he was in, preparing for the jump, collided with another plane that was being used for filming the shot. The two planes exploded mid-air. Everyone aboard both of the airplanes were killed. Mary Astor's dream husband, the first and only man to ever truly love her, was dead. Just like that, Mary's safe haven outside of her parents' so-called safe haven was gone. Mary refused to return to her family home after her husband's tragic death, but she didn't want to be alone. Instead, she went to stay with her dear friends, Frederick and Florence March, before renting an apartment and starting fresh with her life once again. Eventually, she met a new man who would become husband number two, and a key character in the sensational scandal that lay ahead. Mary Astor married 39-year-old Dr. Franklin Thorpe towards the end of 1931. Mary wrote in her diary, quote, "I looked in the mirror and laughed like hell because I had to beg him to marry me. I made him marry me, made him love me," end quote. Mary just needed someone to want her, to need her. As for that diary that she was writing in, Mary kept a diary as an outlet to share her innermost thoughts and feelings. She was never allowed to have friendships as a child. She had some now as an adult, but she always kept a very, very small inner circle. She was shown time and time again that she couldn't trust the people that she should be able to trust. So she needed an emotional outlet for her feelings, and the pages of her diaries provided that for her. Her diaries are the next key figure in the future scandal. The year following their wedding brought daughter Marilyn into Mary and Franklin's lives. Baby Marilyn is the next key figure in the future scandal. The arrival of Marilyn, Mary thought, would be her second chance at happiness, her little family. And Mary wanted part of this new happiness to involve leaving Hollywood behind. She wanted to retire from films, move away from LA, and focus her energy on being a wife and mother. But it wasn't quite that easy. She was still supporting her parents' lavish lifestyle, and Franklin's income as a doctor wasn't quite enough for the life that he and Mary were accustomed to. In fact, it was Franklin who finally demanded that Mary take control of her own paycheck for her acting work. She was 27 years old when this occurred. 27 years old before she finally had financial control over her own hard-earned money. She had been working steadily as a popular silent film star for a decade and had earned $500,000 in that time, which would adjust to about $9.5 million today. And her father had taken it all. She had to put a stop to it, her new husband said. So a new arrangement was made. Mary's parents were put on a tight $100 per month allowance, or $2,300 today. And forced, by the court actually, to sell the mansion and move into a much smaller house. Why was the court involved? Well, Mary's parents sued their daughter for a substantial portion of her earnings, which they, of course, lost. The mansion, worth $200,000 at the time, sold at auction for an astounding $21,000. Those numbers adjusted for inflation would be $4.7 million and $492,700. Someone had a pretty lucky day with that purchase. As was the cycle of events for Mary, she was pretty quickly bored with her second husband, Franklin Thorpe. And Franklin Thorpe wasn't too happy on his side of the marriage either, and he started having an affair. Actually, he had a long-term lover already from before he even met Mary, and it doesn't sound like they ever really severed that relationship. It just wasn't a happy union on either side of the table. Less than 2 years into their marriage, Mary asked Franklin for a divorce. But divorce was out of the question for him. So she started having affairs too. It wasn't a pretty situation. And only if they did go through with that divorce at that time, maybe a lot of future drama could have been prevented. Mary Astor met playwright George Kaufman during a visit to New York in May of 1933, and she was instantly in love, as was standard for her. Kaufman was actually the most celebrated and successful Broadway playwright at the time. He was a pretty big deal. And he was also married, but they kind of had an open marriage agreement. Mary entered into a whirlwind romance with George, and all of her needs were once again fulfilled. Friend Bennett Kerr said of this budding romance, quote, "It was absolute chemistry. It was instant combustion. George was like that. Theirs was such a great, great love affair," end quote. George was like that. Kinda sounds similar to John Barrymore, doesn't it? Well, George Kaufman was quite the ladies' man as well. He was pretty known for his womanizing ways. Still, Mary Astor was intoxicated by him and fell completely under his spell. She was hooked. George lived in New York and Mary lived in LA, so they were only able to see each other when she was able to get out east or on the small chance that George would be in LA. He was a Broadway guy. He was not interested in demoting himself to working in movies. But when MGM head of production Irving Thalberg gave him an offer that he couldn't refuse for a project, George made the trip to Hollywood. And Mary was thrilled. By the time of George's West Coast visit, with his arrival in January of 1935, Mary had come clean with her husband about her affair. She felt safe to do so since Franklin was also still having an affair and had gotten his lover pregnant, and then subsequently performed an abortion on her himself. So with all of it out in the open, Mary felt comfortable with going out freely in LA with George Kaufman. He would be in town for a couple of months, and she was ecstatic. But then Mary's husband, Franklin, decided maybe he wasn't too okay with the idea of his wife gallivanting around town with another man, because it made him look bad. It threatened his manhood, which he was pretty protective of. So he paid George Kaufman a little visit and kindly asked him to back away from his wife. Kaufman, having zero intention of backing away from the man's wife, obliged. He did not want to get entangled in a messy love triangle. His career could be compromised, and there was also the little fact that he, too, was a married man. He just didn't need any messiness in his life. He wanted to have his fun with Mary, but have none of the ugly consequences that tend to come with these situations. So he told Franklin Thorpe that he would step away, that he had no idea the reality of their situation, and that he hoped he could be excused from their private matters. But in reality, he intended to still see Mary. Kaufman told Mary of the visit from her husband when they had dinner together the following night at the Trocadero. And Mary was pissed. She went to her husband and demanded a divorce, and it instantly got really ugly. Franklin Thorpe promised her that he would fight the fight of his lifetime for custody of their young daughter, Marilyn. And he would indeed bring George Kaufman right into it. He would make sure there was a highly publicized scandal with Kaufman's name right in the middle of it. He wanted to make both Mary and her boyfriend suffer. What was already going to be a very dramatic divorce turned a million times more complicated when Franklin Thorpe found his wife's diaries. The one place where she shared her most intimate thoughts and feelings, and where she shared intimate details of her friends as well. Two diaries, each bound with 200 pages. Franklin Thorpe read every single word written in those two diaries. Every word of his wife's most private thoughts. Thoughts she had no intention of another soul ever laying eyes on. He learned exactly how much she despised him. And he learned just how many other men that she had affairs with. And who her friends were having affairs with. He was furious. Thorpe used the diaries as leverage in his divorce plans to get what he wanted. He wanted the money, the home, and their child. He told Mary that she would give him what he wanted, or he would make the diaries public. It would not only ruin her life, but potentially the lives of her friends whose juicy secrets were documented, and the other men that were mentioned in the diaries. Mary felt defeated. Thorpe won, and he walked away from their divorce with a pretty sweet deal, financially and as sole legal guardian of their three-year-old daughter, Marilyn. Mary wanted sole custody of their daughter so badly, but her husband was using her as a pawn. Mary does what he says, or the diaries go public. And then he spun the custody situation to the media that it was Mary's idea that he keep their daughter, that she thought that was the best idea. She would, however, have partial custody of their child throughout the year, but it was a verbal agreement made by Thorpe. And he dictated all the rules and conditions and was happy to tear Marilyn away from Mary if she made the slightest misstep. He controlled everything down to the kinds of meals Mary was feeding their child while in her care. If she didn't follow his very specific rules, he threatened to go back on their verbal custody arrangement. He had full legal custody after all and was just being nice sharing little Marilyn with Mary. He was completely ruling her. Then Mary's friend actress Anne Harding strongly encouraged her to hire a good lawyer and put an end to all of this control and intimidation. She did, and then she prepared for a new career because she thought, even without the diaries being made public, her film career would likely be destroyed by a big custody battle. So she arranged to be the head buyer at the Paris location of the Magnin department store once the trial was over, and her career most likely over too. In early July of 1936, during the hottest heat spell Los Angeles had seen in years, Mary's lawyers filed papers requesting a reversal of the original custody order, charging Thorpe with coercing Mary and threatening to, quote, publicly scandalize her and ruin her career as an actress, end quote. She also filed a complaint charging Thorpe with bigamy and claiming that their marriage was never valid in the first place because he had had a lover so long before and during their marriage that she was considered his common-law wife in the state of Florida, where they had once lived together. Franklin Thorpe, as expected, responded by announcing to the press that he was in possession of some pretty damning personal diaries. Diaries that not only detailed very intimate details of Mary Astor's life, but intimate details of some of Hollywood's biggest names. Sexually explicit details of Mary's high-profile friends and high-profile lovers. And then he started sharing little samples from the diary to get the press all worked up. And worked up they got. The whole point of this nasty legal fight was basically just control. The pleasure of being the winner. All while poor little Marilyn was caught in the middle, being the core of the fight. While it was really never about her. It was about attacking each other and using Marilyn as the pawn to do so. It was a really ugly custody trial, and once Thorpe began sharing snippets from Mary's diaries, reporters from all over the nation began flooding into Los Angeles. This was juicy, juicy stuff. And they knew there was some really good dirt within those once private pages about some other very high-profile celebrities. This was good information for newspapers. The courthouse was a circus during the four-week-long custody trial. The courtroom itself was packed full of people overflowing into the hallway. Remember, it's hot. It's really, really hot. And then in those hallways were food vendors selling snacks. And of course, there was press and cameras everywhere. This was a huge deal, and everyone was glued to the daily happenings. Because the contents of those diaries could become public at any moment. This is where I'm going to leave off for today. Next week, I will dive back into the life of Mary Astor and, more importantly, what happened to that little girl at the center of it all, Mary and Franklin's daughter, Marilyn. And again, expect the story of the beautiful Eva Marie Saint's life and long career on July 8th. Just 4 days after she turns an impressive 101 years old. But next week, the conclusion of Mary Astor and Marilyn Thorpe stories. And then a couple of more little episode announcements. There will be no episodes released on Tuesday, July 15th or Tuesday, August 12th. Life has thrown some life things at me lately, unplanned life things, and I really like everything planned. I require pretty much every minute of my free time to get these episodes out each week, and I finally just accepted that when unplanned circumstances are thrown my way that require my time and energy, I just have to clear my plate a little. So to do that, I'll be taking 1 week off of releasing regular episodes in both July and August. This will help me stay on track, focus on my current family needs, and maybe even have a little leisure time that doesn't include sneaking in podcast research and writing throughout said leisure time. I love it. I really, really do. But I've just been thrown some extra stuff lately that makes my bag of responsibilities overflow a little. So this will offer me the opportunity to still continue researching and writing, but I'll have a little more breathing room to get back on a good schedule with recording and editing episodes. And I plan to get ahead of the game with scripts, so we'll be ready to rock come September. Patreon members, there will be no interruptions there. So just nothing on July 15th or August 12th on the regular feed. But then I want to tell you that on Tuesday, July 22nd, I am partnering again with AC Roberts of the Wanted podcast to cover another riveting old Hollywood crime case. It's a really good one too, so you don't want to miss that. So just skipping 1 week in July and 1 week in August. Otherwise, we're good to go. Thank you guys in advance for understanding. I vowed to always stay consistent, but I realize sometimes that's just not possible when life goes off of its carefully curated route. One more thing before I leave, I want to share a listener review. Do you want your review read on the show? Drop one on Apple Podcasts or comment on an episode on Spotify. The more positive ratings and reviews this show gets, the more ears it can reach. So it's really helpful. This week's review comes from listener Jeanette456 on Apple Podcasts. Along with her 5-star rating, she wrote, "This podcast is well-researched and informative. They are quick hits in terms of the topic, which I appreciate. I would recommend this podcast to anyone who is interested in learning more about the stars from the past. Well done." Thank you so much, Jeanette, for taking the time to leave a review. I'm happy these condensed versions of these remarkable lives sit well. When I was first starting the show and doing research as to what listeners preferred, I found that a good majority of listeners said they enjoyed podcasts that were 25 to 35 minutes long, because that's a good length for a commute. And I'll be honest, that's what I prefer too as a listener. I have tried and tried to get into long-form podcasts, but I just can't do it. I find most of them so dragged out with a lot of useless and repeated information, and I don't like that. I want to give you guys all the meat, nothing extra that will bore you to tears or make you turn off the show. The books I read for my research each week are packed full of every little detail that authors can dig up about their stars, which I appreciate very much. But my goal is to take their details and fine-tune them for an easy and enjoyable listen for you. And using book biographies for my research definitely gives me a lot more to share with you than the basic info found on television biographies or on Wikipedia. So you can always count on that from me. It definitely takes a lot more time each week that I'm reading at least one huge book each week as I write. But to me, it's worth it. I'm learning a lot of good stuff, and I'm loving sharing it with you. So, all of that said, thank you so much again, Jeanette. I'll see you all back next week for the rest of our story. Thank you so much for listening. For this episode, I used the book, The Purple Diaries, Mary Astor and the Most Sensational Hollywood Scandal of the 1930s by Joseph Egan. And, of course, I used my little sidekick, IMDb.